The month is going by quite rapidly. This is Thursday, February 20th already, 2003. Today we're in the public hearing on House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services, Children and Adults and Families. I have to remember to get all this correctly now that we're in combining into different silos. And just some housekeeping items before we start. If there's anyone here who has a cell phone, please remember to turn it off so that it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And also we have Senator Carter isn't here yet. She's our person who is responsible for making certain that Rosie the pig is receiving her fair share of fines. And those fines are as a result of acronyms. On the one hand, we're trying to discourage acronyms. On the other hand, we're also trying to make sure that Rosie is well fed, because the proceeds at the end of session will go to the Oregon Food Bank in order to feed the citizens among us who are hungry, and which is a good cause. I understand that yesterday, when you were going through the discussion, we left off with food stamps. So we will begin today with discussion on food stamps. And I know Arlene is shaking her head, and so she's probably ready to begin. Okay.
You may begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am picking up where I left off yesterday, and that is on page 4-8 of your document that you have there in the food stamp section. What I wanted to talk with you about in closing up this topic is program performance measures. We have two measures that we're looking at, and that is our food stamp error rate measures the accuracy in determining eligibility for benefits. And what I have there for you shows where we were federal fiscal year 01, and the national average, which is not listed there, was 8.66. So we were a little above the national average for 01. And then our projected for 02, which we will receive in June of this year, 03, for our 02 federal fiscal year, is projected to be at 11.01. We will not know until later on in the year what the national average is. That's when it is determined and given to the states. We do have
the reason that it's going up is
there's, Madam Chair, there is several reasons why it could be going up. I think the number one biggest reason is the increase in our caseload that we had over this last year. And then, you know, with the where the economy is that drove folks in to apply, our outreach efforts, those kinds of things. And what we're wanting to do as a state and have a corrective action plan in place in looking at the local level in establishing local measurements versus looking at the quality control reviews that is used to judge our state to other states. It's actually a state review tool. And what we want to do is look at local reviews that can drive our accuracy, so putting more focus on accuracy. And so we have a plan in place to do that, to try to bring this down. Because of the caseload increase, we do believe with FNS that we'll have an opportunity to defer this potential sanction. So we are working on that and are hopeful that that will help reduce this.
But will the federal government still require that they do the still national comparison with what their rate that they're setting?
Madam Chair, yes, we'll still have the requirement at the state level to look at using our quality control reviews. But what we're hoping with our corrective action plan is that when we go to looking at strategies and planning at the local level, that we're looking at those local case reviews and having a larger number of cases reviewed in branches versus the random case review polls that are done with the quality control review process.
Sheila.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just note that in the 0103 biennium, as the caseload in food stamps has increased, as a budget savings measure, the legislature directed the department not to add field staff to deal with that eligibility process. And so when you look at the governor's budget in this area for 0305, when we get to the staffing piece, there's a significant staffing increase as a result of that. But as Arlene indicated, with the increase in caseload, it's not unreasonable, I guess, that there would be an increase in the error rate because we haven't allowed the staffing at the same level as we have had in the past.
Griffin Bates.
Yes, Madam Chair. I asked that we be provided with the actual study that indicated that Oregon was the leading state in the country on hunger, and had an opportunity to read through that last night, and I was rather stunned to find out this is a self-reported study. It is not well done randomly, and in the study itself, they questioned their own findings concerning the states of Washington and Oregon. And we've been kind of running off this report as the basis for where we stand as far as hunger, and I question the validity of this study. I don't know if you do also. Having read through it, I haven't seen the actual, but a synopsis of it makes me wonder what we're looking at here. Also, I thought I saw figures indicated that on the basis of people in poverty receiving food stamps, that Oregon stands quite high in that. I wonder if you could comment on both those situations.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates. On the first question in regards to the validity of the hunger data, there's always questions about the validity and where the data comes from. What we're looking at is that being a tool that the states are using, and so we are operating by that and working towards continuing to improve as our piece with the food stamp program to address hunger in the state. So knowing that food stamps is not the one and only piece that affects hunger. So we're working with what we are given. And on the second question around, I believe you're referring to the handout C that we had yesterday. And what that is telling us is that it's the a picture that gives you the number of Oregonians that are in poverty, that are receiving food stamps, and it's a comparison of two. You have the folks that are on food stamps comparing to those that are in poverty using the 2000 census. So it's actually a comparison of the two. So it's a ratio, it's a subset, two different subsets of Oregonians.
In our ranking, Madam Chair, follow-up?
A follow-up.
How do we rank with other states?
Looking at, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, with this data that you had in front of you on handout C, it shows you that we are at the top at 0.963, so that we are doing very well based off of the October food stamp numbers. And, again, it's compared to the 2000 census.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Chia.
The longer I go, the more questions I get. the first one does, well, I've got them written here, and I guess I should stick with Representative Bates first and just ask, I know you've got this study, but don't you have other sources of information about, you know, how much hunger there is? I mean, our own food bank network should be able to give us some clue, because they do comparisons between our state and other states. You have, I mean, number one, I'm not sure that we should spend as much time challenging, and I don't direct this at you, Representative Bates, yes, challenging the questions and the questionnaires as we should addressing hunger, you know. But number two, I think there are some other sources. I know the Hunger Relief Task Force has done a lot of work in this area.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, there are other reports that are also used, and there is the one survey that's called the Current Population Survey, the CPS, and that is also one that is used to gather information.
And where are we on that?
It is supporting, to a certain degree, the Brandis report.
Okay. Madam Chair, my question had arise just a moment ago out of your comments about error rate. And legislative staff here just confirmed it, that if we're cutting staff, we don't expect the error rate to come down as fast. Is there a chance that the government, the federal government, in its attempt to get our error rate down, won't sanction us some if we don't keep our staffing up? Do you follow the kind of the inverse correlation that I'm talking about here?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, if you're asking if FNS looks at our staffing versus where our error rate's been and looking at our getting more staff to be able to deliver the benefits.
Or cutting our staff because of our staff, budget crisis.
My understanding is that FNS works with us in giving us suggestions. I'm sorry. I had a I used FNS.
My contribution.
Thank you, Ramona. The Federal Nutrition Services. What I understand is that we are working closely with Dennis Stewart, who is the director, our Western Region director, and he works with us on suggesting strategies. And it's up to the states on how we implement our corrective action. And given some of his suggestions, we're implementing that along with some of the ideas that we have that will help us move forward in bringing down the error rate.
I'd like to ask a question. Is if I went to one of the food banks, and I know that the food banks also shares its information of the number of people who come in and request foods. Could I get a basket of food? I'm asking that because what is the criteria, the basis of which one gets food from the food banks?
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with what the criteria is with the food banks.
Sheila, would you try to find out from and determine what are the guidelines? How, you know, because if their figures are also used in the data that we collect in order to determine where the needs are, I think it's also that things, something should be compatible here, or where you're, so you're, we're not doing apples and bananas and making a tossed salad, but I think it's probably a Waldorf. If I'm with the fruits that I'm using. But you see where I'm headed, that we have some consistency somewhere when we're looking at eligibility issues.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I could just give a little context to the committee. The food stamp program is in children, adults, and families. There are other hunger relief associated programs in the budget for Department of Housing and Human Services, and they do operate the money that goes out on the state level to the food banks, but I will try to get that information for the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I had some other questions, but I have given you a copy of them and Arlene a copy, and I hope Arlene and I can get together. And
Arlene, could you respond to Senator Shields' questions in writing so that we can share them with the rest of the members?
And I might suggest, Madam Chair, by the way, I want to thank you for the piggy out there, because I've been too embarrassed to ask what FNS meant, and they say it so fast I didn't even know there was an N in the middle.
Since you
we now know it's food nutrition services. No, Madam Chair, I'm just on record here as thanking you for helping me to understand this issue.
You know, but I think that since we're talking about the issue of hunger, and the purpose of Rosie there is to collect as much as she can. And I know if Senator Carter was here, Senator Carter would, in fact, and I'll put it on her little note, to have a discussion with Senator Shields and his contribution to Miss Rosie.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to put money into the piggy, but at the same time, I'm going to challenge you to fast with me next Wednesday during the Hunger Awareness Week. Thank you.
Water's good. Continue.
Thank you. The second performance measure we've talked about, and that is the ratio of Oregonians receiving food stamps to the number of Oregonians living in poverty, and we've talked about that performance measure. And then what I wanted to do in concluding my presentation is just talk with you a little bit about some of the accomplishments that we've had in working with the food stamp program and delivering benefits in Oregon. We, in 2000, had DHS contracted with Oregon SafeNet to provide a toll-free telephone number for Oregonians to use to be able to get information and resource referral information, that kind of thing, for the food stamp program. And we also have outreach contracts that we have folks out in different areas of the state that are working on food stamp outreach. And we also are working very closely and continue to work very closely with our community partners, our hunger advocates. I'm a part of several committees that work with the planning and strategizing for the work that we want to do, and closely work with them and looking at our policies and that kind of thing. Most recently, my partnership with Oregon Department of Education has brought us to a place where we have a form that was developed that local offices are using now to help facilitate free and reduced meals for families. And that has also helped the schools in serving those children that could qualify. So we think that has been a success. And that we're also continuing to looking at ways we can streamline processes and work with our advocates in that planning. And with that, I conclude my presentation, unless there's questions.
Just one other question. How much have we paid over the 6 years in penalty?
The total number in 6 years? I don't have, if I had a calculator, I could calculate it for you real quickly, but I have, okay, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, could you please repeat the question?
Okay. In your accomplishments during that you state in 0203, you state that Oregon has been in penalty status for 6 years due to an unacceptable error rate. Mm-hmm. And if you're in that status, what does it cost us?
Okay.
From the general fund.
Okay. Madam Chair, it's not costing us anything, because what we have opted to do is reinvest, and what we do is reinvest what the penalty would have been into doing corrective action. So it's not costing us anything.
Okay. Because if I just read that, I would think that we've been paying a penalty for 6 years out of general fund, and so what you're telling me is that the agreement with the federal government is that there's reinvestment back into the program.
Thank you.
And here, what does reinvest mean?
We're looking at
how much money was reinvested?
Well, the question is, how much would you have been fined by the federal government that went back into what you were doing?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, Representative Smith, for federal fiscal year 01, our potential sanction that we would have paid out would be $3,964.
Oh.
And for the one previous year, it was $123,000. And so that's what we would have paid out, but we did not have to do that because we were given the opportunity to reinvest that into corrective action. And reinvestment is an opportunity to take the sanction and reinvest it back into the delivery of the benefits in regards to accuracy.
A better way of putting this is what they're saying is that if you will improve your system in some way, we will not require that you pay the $123,000.
Thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Follow-up, Representative Bates.
Does that mean you hired more people to work?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, no. Each year, there were different things that we did in regards to reinvesting. What I can tell you, last year for 2000, we reinvested in having food stamp conferences regionally that brought in staff to observe several different workshops that would help them with their accuracy in delivering benefits. There was different topics that helped within balancing the increased caseload and the delivering of the benefits. What we're going to be doing for the 01 is that we're going to bring food stamp reviewers together and talk about that local review process that I was talking with you about earlier and looking at local performance. So it's up to us to be able to say where we are in that certain time about what we want to do.
Mr. Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm a slow learner here. You're fined $3,000 last year and $120,000 the year before. Round numbers. And you had to reinvest that money. So my question is where did that money come from?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Westland, my understanding is that would have been dollars that if we did not reinvest would have been paid out to the federal government for the penalty that we were cited. And we were given the opportunity not to pay it out, but to reinvest into efforts that would help bring that accuracy to a place that would not put us into continued...
I understand that part. The federal government... Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And I mean, help me with this. I'm just having trouble. The federal government said you aren't doing the job according to our standards, so we're going to, quote, fine you. Well, let's just take the low number, $3,000. Where did that $3,000 come from to reinvest?
Madam Chair, Representative...
You had your hand slapped, $3,000 fine. Okay, fine. They say, but we really want you to continue doing these services, so don't pay us. Put $3,000 into the program. Where did the $3,000 come from?
Jim, can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Deputy Director, Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, Representative Westland, the money that was used for reinvestment is actually diverted from other program areas. For instance, if we have an issue with food stamp accuracy eligibility that we're talking about, in this case, the feds would say if we're fined $3,000, you have to find $3,000 elsewhere, put it back into the mix, and you can't charge us for that. So, for instance, typically what we would do is we would say, well, ordinarily worker A is spending 50% of his time on food stamps in terms of the charging off and 50% on temporary assistance to needy families. Now it's got to be 51% on temporary assistance to needy families, 49% on food stamps in terms of the charging, although they have to actually contribute that time to the food stamp program. So it's within our budget that its funds are moved around.
But I'll follow up.
So functionally what you're saying is that you shorted another program to make up for a federal fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I guess as a practical matter, that's a way to describe it.
And another
follow-up.
And we give you given amounts of money for given specific purposes, And for you to spend that money, you have to have an expenditure limitation. And so my question is, did you come back to this body after those fines? I think you did, if my memory serves, in Ebor.
The 3,000, they don't.
The expenditure limitation.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I don't know that we came back specifically for expenditure limitation because typically I believe we have excess limitation.
Right.
But we do typically report, as we're doing now, to the subcommittee in terms of where we are with penalties.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I think you have excess non-limited funds, and those are primarily other and federal funds, but I don't think you have flexibility in your expenditure limitation for general fund, and it would be my impression that what we're talking about here is general fund limitation.
If I can try.
Perhaps you can shed some, as
a practical matter, the way the Department of Human Services budget is set up, we have the budget bill is set up by program area cluster. For 2001-03, adult and family services was one line item. So all of the general fund for adult and family services was within one line item. All of the general fund for, or all of the other funds and federal funds for adult and family services were separate line items. Now, within that one line item, this agency and every agency has some latitude on managing that budget that the general fund appropriation is determined to be the maximum amount that they are to spend in the biennium to carry out the programs that the legislature has directed them to carry out. With the Department of Human Services, they have come to the emergency board for budget rebalance plans on a periodic basis, as you've seen several times this biennium, and where there are significant changes between line item appropriations, that's what that rebalance is addressing. But a $3,000 fine in a $200 million general fund budget would not normally be of the magnitude that they would come to the emergency board and say, well, we're switching this $3,000 from our food stamp program administration or from our TANF program administration to food stamps. So they do have latitude within that line item appropriation.
Does that clarify it?
Yeah, but that's 1 year and then 120, and what are the other 4 years, and what's that add up to? And, of course, that's over several biennium. I'm not mad. I'm just a little uncomfortable.
Representative Westland, under routine circumstances, through the rebalance, where they're having problems in a particular category, they do bring those issues forward to the emergency board when we're not in session.
Yeah, and that's what I'm remembering.
But it's rebalance when we pick up the problems or the issues. If they're out of compliance with the feds, they came to us when there was when they requested an increase in staff. Because of the issue, the decision that was made when we cut back their staff, that was done at eBoard along with this issue. So they do, and it usually occurs normally through the rebalance. Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, by the way, I have to go to my other committee, so I will deposit my money in the piggy down there, but but I really want to urge the committee to think about one thing, and that is I've wandered into various field offices. I've watched food stamp people do their work. The line is sometimes out the door. We are saying work faster, work harder. By the way, there's going to be less people to do the work, and by the way, make fewer errors. Not only have I seen those offices in operation, but I've talked to the people in the AAAs, the area agencies on aging, where they end up being told the same thing, and they've had the error problem. And I have heard that they really do appreciate the helpful comments that they sometimes get from these meetings that help them to reduce their error rate. So I think it's a reinvestment, but it's a pretty good investment for us to be making. I just wanted to say that.
Cost you twice now because she had two comments.
Are there any more questions of the committee?
No, thank you very much. Uh-huh.
Please,
we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
In case there's more.
Rosie appreciates it.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, Ramona.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley, and I'm the acting administrator for self-sufficiency and child safety programs. And I was going to talk to you about two programs this afternoon. The first is employment-related daycare, and the second is temporary assistance to needy families. So I think with that, I think I'll go ahead and get into the employment-related daycare discussion. The employment-related daycare program is essentially designed to help low-income working families with daycare costs so that they can maintain their employment. It is currently serving families with income levels up to 150% of poverty level.
I believe that the panel has a copy of what is poverty levels.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is 150% of poverty level effective this month. Prior to this month, it was 185% of poverty level. That's one of the budget reductions we took, is to drop that level down to 150%. 150% of poverty level for a family of three is 1878 prior to February, and I think then it drops to it increases to 1903 in fact, in February of 03. There are the program serves about 11,000 families in a given month, and that translates into 23,000 children are receiving subsidy for child care. So how the program works, this is essentially a subsidy program, and it involves a copay. So the payment to the child care provider is made up of two payments. There's the copay that the participant pays, and then there's the department subsidy that the department makes directly to the provider. The average copay is $122. And if I could direct your attention to page 415, what you'll see there is a chart. Now, this is prior to February where there were changes, but what you'll see there is a distribution of copays by dollar amounts. It just shows it in terms of $25 is the first copay, and then it gradually goes down, and it's all based on income. Okay.
What would be the income level of the one that's about 600 plus?
I'm sorry?
What would be the income level of the 600 plus?
I'm following that case. What would that person's income level be?
Madam Chair, I'll have to. I'm sorry?
The majority of the copays are $25.
They were right now, Madam Chair. We lost the 25 copay, and it all dropped to the average is now 43.
43
is the lowest copay now.
So if I look from $43, and is that a month, week, or what's the?
That's a month.
That's
a monthly copay.
So the average copay is 43 a month, and the high end is 60.
Madam Chair, the average copay is 122. Okay. The lowest copay is 43.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for some figures that I don't expect you to have today. If you can give them to us later, it would be really, really helpful. I'd like to know on employment-related daycare what the total cost of the program is on a biennium, how much of that is federal monies, how much of it is state monies. I remember also from last time around on this budget that we tried to track the different ways an individual could access and help with daycare, and there were like five or six different avenues, not just this one, but there was employment tax credit on the federal and state level and several other programs, and I never could actually follow all the tracks of money that became available to an individual family, and I'm not sure they could either. And I wonder if you would have any opportunity to kind of bring that together for us to look at. I remember I think there were three or four different tracks of money coming in, and I don't know how these people get through the maze to figure out what's really available to them or not.
Well, we can certainly, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can certainly pull that together for you. There is a effective this year, there is a refundable tax credit that goes into effect this year.
That affects this group too, I would guess.
It will. Most certainly it will. This group will get an additional financial benefit, but it really won't help very much with the monthly cost of daycare, simply because it amounts to a tax resource once a year. So it's not usable on a month-to-month, practically speaking. But ultimately, for the year, it certainly will be benefit.
Madam Chair,
follow-up.
This is more of a request than a question. Try to bring all that together for us, if
sure.
You could. It might be something your agency is concerned about, because you're obviously involved in child care. If you could bring it all together in one packet, it might be useful for us to look at and get a better understanding of what's available for these people. And, of course, we'd like to see the actual figures for your program.
Fine.
Thank you.
It would also, while you're putting together some information for us, if you would include within your categories individuals who are post or secondary students. I don't think it's any secret in this building that that's been one of my concerns, and I know that we've lost that funding
for
that population.
Student block grant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the way the system works, the department pays the provider directly. The department copay, department payment, and the participant's copay really amounts to about 87%. Of what the provider would typically charge for that service. And unfortunately, what that means is oftentimes the participant is pretty much forced to either one of two things happens. If we're paying 87% of what a provider would typically charge, either the client is forced to pay an additional amount to make up the difference, or the provider has to essentially lower their costs. But either way, the copay and the department payment don't match up with what the market rate in terms of what a provider would charge. And so what happens is you have two daycare delivery systems. You have the formal system that is available through market, and then you wind up having a much more informal system for those individuals who are close to the poverty line, or somewhere between 100% of poverty and 150% of poverty, and that's a much more informal system, family-based care, and that is what the lion's share of our participants access. And I'll get into that a little bit. But so we have two standards of payments. We have a standard payment and we have an enhanced payment system. And the enhanced rate is based on the provider's training, education and training around specifically around certain items relative to child care. The education of providers, child abuse and neglect, reporting child abuse and neglect, first aid, CPR, food handler's permit, and child development training. So if a provider has undergone a certain amount of training, then they qualify for an enhanced rate.
And what's that rate?
That rate is essentially, got that back here for you. I'm sorry? 7.5% higher than the standard rate. Right now, family providers, there's about 17% of family-based providers qualify for the enhanced rate, and that is about 23% of the overall providers qualify for the enhanced rate.
So 17% of, let's say...
Family-based.
Family-based, which may be grandparents and a relative that is... And so if they took training, and then they receive a 7.5% rate increase. How much does it cost the person in the family to access this training? What's the training cost?
Training they get to be the enhanced rate. Is there a charge for the training?
Madam Chair, there isn't a charge for that. That is provided by the child care system through the Employment Department and the child care information and resource and referral systems.
So
they don't typically have to pay to access the training.
So inside of, so Employment Division's budget would contain the training dollars for this particular function. Does the agency, are you involved with the Employment Division in helping to set some of the standards or some of the training needs at all?
We work with the Employment Department and the Information and Referral System in terms of the whole management of how providers get this information and get the training. There are essentially five organizations that are involved in the overall quality issues and technical support for child care providers. There is the whole licensing process through Child Care Division. Then what the department does in terms of listing providers and providing the enhanced pay for those that have qualified. And there's the Child Care Information and Resource and Referral Organizations. There are about 16 statewide, and they work closely with providers to develop skills. And then the Portland State University operates a mentor program for providers as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gortley.
Thank you very much. While we're on the subject of training and education for these providers, I recall that last session, or maybe it was a session before that, there was legislation related to educating daycare providers about brain development. What happened with that implementation?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that is actually part of the enhanced package in terms of child development training. It's one of the components that a provider has to undergo so many hours of training every 2 years. But child development is one of the issues, one of the items on the list for training that they have to complete.
So we did, Madam Chair,
so
we did implement.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you.
I guess I've always struggled ever since I've been back in this building, having come from the side when daycare services and services that related to children, when we talk about standards and we talk about quality of care, and some of those issues were not in, quote, the employment realm, because their function was a little different, and I'm trying to, for myself, kind of imagine how it all comes together, particularly on the protection side. I've been struggling with this ever since a couple of days, and Ramona's kind of smiling because she knows where I'm going, and because on the one hand, if you're looking at daycare, you have the protection side and those standards, and so I'm trying to get who's involved in assuring that those kind of quality issues are there. And you said that there was some group that meets with the Employment Division.
There is a group that I think really rep is from the Child Care Development Advisory Group. There is a Child Care and Education Coordinating Council. And essentially representatives from Child Care Division, Department of Human Services, and the Child Care Information and Resource and Referral in Portland State attempt to coordinate the whole process of how to manage the general care, the quality of care that providers care, that provide to.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, I understand. Sheila.
Let me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just a little bit of history, and I don't remember the dates exactly, but responsibility for child care at one point in the far distant past did reside with the Department of Human Resources. It was moved out to the Employment Department because of the belief that child care was more than just a low income issue, that it was an employment issue, and that putting it into the Employment Department, it would get more visibility at the in the private sector, and that there could be more assistance provided it from that standpoint. And so the pieces that are in the Department of Human Services, primarily in terms of funding, relate to employment-related daycare, and you'll see a few other very targeted daycare programs as we work through these budgets. But the overall statutory responsibility for child care in Oregon is now with the Employment Department, and they are the lead agency in terms of the Child Care Coordinating Council and bringing all the players to the table, both in the private and public sector. And they're also the agency that's responsible for delivering or developing an allocation plan and monitoring the plan for the child care and development funds, about $90 million of which is in this budget, but there's other pieces elsewhere. And so it's difficult when you're looking at just this budget to be able to address all the issues surrounding child care, because they do have a more limited role than was the case 10 years ago.
Sheila, is it possible for, because I believe that, I don't know if that agency comes to us or not. I don't believe it.
The Employment Department goes to another subcommittee.
It goes to another subcommittee. Would you ask them, because since part of their function is to not to deal with the quality issue, which children and families I'm sure is interested in, but you also stated that that their role is to look at expanding daycare, particularly in the private sector and working with the employer. And these issues was there when I was there 18 years ago when we had 4 C's. It was the coordinated child care. That was back a lot of years. And we had wanted to get the private sector more involved in child care and some of the, even having facilities with inside their companies, and you know, I want to know what they've done since they now are responsible. Have they been successful in getting the private sector to develop child care facilities within their companies and plants? Because if that really is that is part of the mission, and also how they interface or how they work with the human services, particularly adult and children and families. I'm not going to say an acronym.
We will ask.
You do pay double for that, don't you?
Yes, I do. Oh, and you notice how I didn't even refer to my old agency either. That was very good today.
Did he mention the 4 C's there, though?
Okay, you got it.
Well, I got my two. I just said, we're going to pony up here, aren't we?
Okay. Thank you.
There are two types of providers. There are family providers and center-based providers. 93% of our of the providers that provide care to our participants are family-based. There are about 5 separate rate structures based on the age of the child. I think, as I mentioned before, there is essentially 2 child care delivery systems. One is a much more informal system, and that most of our participants are in. The employment-related daycare program and the caseload and the temporary assistance, the needy family caseload, have an inverse relationship. Since 1995, between 1995 and year 2000, there has been, and you can probably see this increase on page 413. There has been about a 4,000 case increase between 95 and 2000, and that amounts to about a 50% increase. During that same period, 95 to 2000, there's been a 23,000 case decrease in temporary assistance to needy families. And then since 2000 to now, there has been a decrease of about 1,100 cases in employment-related daycare and a corresponding increase of about 3,000 cases in temporary assistance to needy families. So, and it's about a 10% difference between 50% and 60%, 9%, 19%. So what you have is just this segment of the population that, based on the strength of the economy and the labor market, goes back and forth between these programs. And during times when we have a lot of placements and things are good, TANF will go down. Employment-related daycare, as we are placing people in marginal jobs, goes up. The need goes up, and then as those jobs deteriorate, the TANF goes back up, and the employment-related daycare goes down. So you have this group that kind of goes back and forth between these programs based on what's happening in the labor market. Factors that impact cost of the program: families leaving TANF for employment. As I just explained, as people leave TANF, large sizable percent will go into employment-related daycare. The amount of copay obviously affects the cost of the program. Rates providers are paid, the standard versus enhanced rates, and the whole number of families in family-based care versus centers. Budget reductions that we have, that the program has experienced in the current biennium, there have been a total of four. In November 2002.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does the Employment Division give a high priority on the individuals who are in TANF that you're working with?
Madam Chair, no, I don't believe they do. I think it is simply there based on people in terms of applying. There isn't a priority.
So it's still that the work of working with the TANF families and working to get employment and some of those issues is still with the agency?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. The student block grant was eliminated in November 2002, and that was child care to students, and there were about 337 families impacted that November. And we had a series of three reductions in February that were put into place this month that all related to employment-related daycare. First was an increase in minimum copay. That is the dropping out, the termination of the $25 copay and moving it so that the minimum copay is now $43. 335 families that left employment-related daycare due to that increase. And there was an elimination of the reduced initial 2 months of copays. As someone leaves temporary assistance to needy family and they transition into employment-related daycare, what the program did do in order to help the transition into employment was to essentially freeze the minimal copay at $25 for the first 2 months. That's one of the program enhancements that was lost this month. And there was an average of about 890 families that took advantage of those two-month copays, those freezing of copays. It was about $1.2 million. Then, then the last reduction went in place in February is their eligibility limits, as I explained earlier, were reduced from 185% to 150%. Let's see. Performance measures. There are no formal performance measures as such. The department has had an informal measure of wanting to establish the percent of providers that qualify and receive the enhanced rate for the better services. We've had an informal target of 25%, and to date, we have reached about 23%. And the only other that performance measure that relates, there is an Oregon benchmark that says that 10% of families' income should, no more than 10% of families' income should be spent on child care. And currently about 50% of the program's participants reach that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that completes the presentation on employment-related daycare.
Thank you very much. I think we've questioned you along the way.
All right.
Senator Carter.
I just wanted to, I can't think of Tom's last name from the Employment Division.
Tom, Madam Chair Carter, it's Tom Olson.
Yes. Between him and you guys in terms of child care, I just want to give kudos because it's just wonderful. When I was looking at opportunity for child care in North Portland, he was right there. And since I didn't stay at building week, I didn't get a chance to talk any further about it. But thank you so much. I just wanted to give you kudos on record.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you very much. Madam Chair, if you're ready, I'll be ready to proceed into the temporary assistance to needy families.
You go right ahead.
All right. Temporary assistance to needy families was established in 1996. It is a replacement for the Aid to Dependent Children program, and in its in that replacement.
Did you know he said that without doing an acronym?
Hey, I'm trying very hard.
We ought to find him for that.
Madam Chair, but I'm ready to contribute. That transition changed the entire premise of the program. Prior to 96, the premise of the program was a maintenance program, and it was essentially an entitlement program. As long as you met the basic eligibility criteria for the program, then you would continue to receive benefits. The object of the program was to continue to provide those maintenance benefits to families for as long as they qualified. And the object of our delivery was to do that as accurately and as swiftly as we can. But with the creation of the temporary assistance to needy families, the whole premise changed. And it stopped being a maintenance program, and it became a temporary program with the object of transitioning families from assistance into self-sufficiency primarily through employment. So the focus changed. It was no longer a benefit delivery system as much as it was a service delivery system. The maintenance payments follow along, but the focus of the program shifts from benefit delivery to service delivery.
For the sake of this conversation,
Senator Carter,
for the sake of this conversation, would you define to me what you mean by from a benefit system to a service system?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, maintenance payments, the monthly grant, is what I refer to as maintenance. The monthly grant that we provide families to pay the rent and to pay the utilities.
That's the benefit.
That's the benefits.
Okay.
The service component is really the employment services provided through the jobs program.
Okay. Follow up. So since we have lost programs like Jobs Plus and that kind of stuff, what would the services delivery system look like now?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, it will not look that much different than it looks now. And I have a chart that I can explain in a little bit that really kind of tells you the kinds of services that we provide in the jobs program and at what the rates are, both in terms of the dollars spent as well as the number of participants that are active in them, the types of services, whether it's classroom training, whether it's work experience. If you want to go to that, we can go to that now.
Follow up. The reason I'm asking these questions because the other day I'm on the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we went to the Oregon Department of Employment last week and to try to walk through some potential clients, people just leaving the prison system, as well as some structurally, because I have a problem with structurally unemployed, Ms. Ramona, in northeast Portland. So these are the people who need very intense life skill training, very intense support systems for, you know, getting back into the workplace. So how do we, so that these people are not faced with many of the sanctions that come as a result of if you don't do, but how do we take in consideration that there are certain things, there's a certain amount of onerousness on us as a state to give these people the life skill training, if indeed we're going to try to put them into a workplace, and especially in the kind of market that we have today?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, from our perspective, there's really two aspects of delivering employment services to populations that are served through temporary assistance to needy families. There is the development of the hard skills in terms of which you could typically get in classroom or in worksite. But from our perspective, particularly working with those that those individuals who may be less than job ready, there is a whole need around infrastructure and support.
Okay.
That passive delivery systems, if you just created a program and said, we'll pay for you to go take these classes, or there's the employment department, they'll help you get a job. There's no structure with that. There is no, as you mentioned, there's no soft skill development. There's no job readiness. And it is critical to the delivery of these services that there is that the system provide infrastructure that really delivers both support to the individual and the family while they're accessing the skill development. Because without that, we have seen time and time again that individuals fail. They're unable to complete the skill development activities without the necessary amount of infrastructure support, both for the case management system that technically helps the participant be successful in those activities. It is not enough to make those activities available, simply available. We have to make them available in a way that's going to ensure that the individual be successful. And I think the deeper you get into serving a population with job readiness issues, the more structural kinds of supports and issues that the system needs to provide. And this is one of the critical issues in reauthorization, and one of the issues that I think Oregon is going to face that I'll get into in a little bit as we talk about reauthorization.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
All right.
The challenge is great. I guess I'm sitting here and I'm hearing you talk, and I'm thinking about, and I'm not going to say the acronym, I'll say the specific program that was in the Department of Labor, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. Because what you're describing is what the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act provided for back, I want to say, 30 years ago. And if I sound frustrated, I think, you know, we keep talking about certain issues. We know from empirical data, we know from studies, we know that with certain populations, particularly talking about individuals coming out of systems, that they need a lot more coaching, hand-holding, a lot more than you do if you have someone who had not been out of the job market. That's true if you're talking about individuals on, who have been a long time on the workers' comp system, if they've been on, because what has happened is that they've gotten into routines or patterns that are not conducive to employment. I guess I say that with a sense of frustration because it always sounds like we're reinventing wheels when actually Jobs Plus was put in place in jobs to do some of those very things that we were doing in a Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, which was through the Department of Labor. So I would like to know, you know, when Senator Carter raised that, it was raised from the standpoint of how do we get there? I mean, how do we, even within our limited resource environment, we still cannot, you know, leave this behind. And I know Representative Westland is down there at the other end waiting to talk on this subject as well.
Well, it just sounds like, is it Michael?
Yes.
It sounds like Senator Carter and Senator Winters and the witness are all kind of saying the same thing in some regard, and that is, you know, we regrettably Jobs Plus went the way of the dinosaur and all the budget cuts, but you can't look at this quote population, you know, and apply, you know, for all the good that Jobs does, which is a tremendous amount of good, there are aspects and benefits to both Jobs and then a more difficult population that I think Jobs Plus has some applicability for. So when we get around to discussing this and get to work session, I hope we can craft kind of a hybrid version of both programs, take the best out of both, because both have very good applications to our current day situations, and some have some that aren't as desirable. And with the limited resources, I hope we can target a Jobs/Jobs Plus type package. I don't care what you call it. But there are different categories of populations that one or the other doesn't get.
Waiting for him to do an acronym.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, one of the complicating factors here is where historically terms and conditions under which we're used to designing programs, if we have the idea and the concept, Oregon waivers essentially allowed us to design it and put it into place if we could afford to do it. One of the complications of TANF reauthorization is that the states will be working from a much more restrictive list of services that they can provide and essentially receive credit in a participation rate calculation that the federal government has been using. So the list of kinds of services that we can provide and receive credit is, this will be new to us. Under the Oregon waiver, we can essentially count any service that we deem appropriate. Under reauthorization, if in fact we lose the waivers, and it certainly appears as though we will, and we'll talk about waivers in a couple of minutes, we'll be working with a fairly short list of activities that the program will be able to provide. And unfortunately, one of the primary issues is that while you will be able to count certain kinds of activities that develop hard skills, the very infrastructure support that I think we have just concluded are critical to success of individuals is not a counted activity. It's not something that we will be able, so funding that we put in for that infrastructure for support of individuals will not translate into accountable activity in terms of meeting the federal participation rate. It assumes almost that you have individuals who could go into a work experience component or a classroom and participate on their own at an X number of hours a week, and that is essentially the measurement. So the fact that you have to spend 50% of your funding on infrastructure necessary to support that individual to make that happen, to make that individual successful in that classroom, the system, the measurement, is blind to.
Senator Carter.
Staff's going to ask, make a suggestion that if the system is blind to certain acts and you won't be you won't be account, you won't be counted in an accountable way part. I was going to say, what happened to the old partnerships that we had with students going to the community college, and what happened to community-based programs that have certain life skill classes? But you're saying that they would not count that because it doesn't sound like a formalized partnership. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, there are certain kinds of those. Most of those services that were provided through community colleges and Workforce Investment Act Title I providers, the old job training partnership act system, the services that we access through jobs are on contract. So we set out specifications, and then we contract with those providers to provide those services. So what's going to happen under reauthorization is we'll simply redefine the services that we're able to buy. And so rather than life skills, we're going to be looking at various layers of work experience because reauthorization will force us to invest our money in more hard skill development because of the limited number of activities. And then it's just an extent and our ability to pay for the individual infrastructure for support of individuals to the extent that we can afford to pay for those. But that'll almost be a secondary. And in fact, in the strategy we've laid out, those life skills and that infrastructure support is, in fact, was classified as secondary level of service. Because the primary services, the hard skill development, will cost us so much of the money that we have available.
Wow. Further question? Thank you.
Okay. Let me backtrack a little bit. With the creation of temporary assistance to needy families, there was established a time limit. Now, Oregon due to the Oregon waivers, we have not really experienced the time limit. Well, we do, but we don't. We have the ability to suspend the clock for any individual who's participating in the program. So the net effect is they don't have a time limit, as long as they're participating in services. But on a national level, there's a 5-year, 60-month time limit. And with our waivers, the Oregon waivers expire at the end of June. And there is no provision for extending those waivers, which means we become a time-limited program effective July 1st. We get to start the clock from the beginning. Our 5-year clock starts in July, but we nevertheless do have a clock. So that's one of the, it's just one of the aspects that I think will make our program different than what it is now. Right
so
now, the program.
What are the possibilities of the waiver? Are you thinking in terms of re-requesting the waiver, or due to the loss?
Senator Chair, Senator Carter, we have made numerous efforts to try to extend the waiver. We have been working pretty extensively with Senator Smith's office, particularly in trying to secure conditions under which waivers are extended. The federal government has not, this is not something that they want to do. And frankly, the odds of us being able to secure extension of our waivers are, I would classify as remote. One of the complications is that the block grant, the temporary assistance needed block grant, actually technically expired in September. And so what we're doing right now is just living off of extensions. And that extensions will probably run into September of 03 of this year. If reauthorization, there currently is no provision for extending any waivers. There's about 9 states that have waivers. There's no provision for extending them now. And the federal government is not interested in negotiating any kind of extension thus far, which means that ours dies June 30th. And so when reauthorization comes up and finalized this fall, there's nothing to extend. They're finished. And it's just the question then becomes, can a state reapply for waivers? And so far, in the legislative concepts that we are looking at in terms of reauthorization, and it's just how we can gauge what reauthorization is going to mean to us, The odds of us being able to reapply for a waiver similar to what ours are now are just about non-existent. particularly our waivers got at two critical issues. It was the system's ability to define what services go into a plan and have those services count towards participation. And that's important because that allows us to provide the life skills and their job readiness kinds of services and count them. We can even count when a participant's in mental health or substance abuse services as a countable activity. And that's a big deal. That allows us to have a participation rate of 72% when the nation level is something like 34%. But we're going to lose that. Yeah, because we will have to be, the only services that will be countable in our system are those that are countable under the Act. And the second is the number of hours a week. Right now, we can set the hours a week of participation for an individual based on individual need. And with reauthorization, it will be 40 hours a week and 24 in countable activities and worksite-based activities. So it's going to be much more stringent in terms of its requirements. There are the program currently serves on average about 18,000 families a month. 95% of those families are single parent households. Benefits provided through the system are at subsistence levels only. 71% of poverty level, when you include the grant, the maintenance grant, plus the value of food stamps, is still only 71% of poverty level. So this is subsistence level only. Family of three, it's a grant of $498 a month. This benefit level. Give you some idea. It has not been adjusted since 1991, which is about 12 years. Effective February 1st, we reduced those grants by $5 as one of our cost-cutting measures.
From 498 to
499. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Carter, the grant was 503, and it was been reduced to 498, so it's 498 right now.
Okay.
Benefits are delivered through our electronic benefit transfer system so that participants can withdraw cash from grocery stores or cash machines.
Was that the Oregon Trail, Carter?
Yes, it is. They can draw their temporary assistance needy family benefits from that same system.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Buckley, if you could help me think through something here. So we, starting on July 1, will be under the new federal guidelines. The waiver goes away.
Senator Gordley, we would actually become, we would fall under the current because reauthorization legislation has not been passed yet, so we don't know for sure what those regulations are going to be. What we'll fall under is the current set of regulations that are being extended.
Thank you for correcting my understanding. And we have 18,000 people who would be affected.
That's correct. Families.
Families. Projecting ahead, and I know this would require looking at a set of assumptions, but projecting ahead and thinking about that 5-year cliff, what are you projecting?
We, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have not made a formal projection of that yet. In terms of the number of families that would be left after 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
The average stay on assistance is averaging about 22 months now. But that's the average. And so obviously we have families that have been on for extended periods of time. But we have not made that projection. I think we're still waiting for it to become finalized and developing a system that will count months and be able to project that.
All right. So you would be, Madam Chair, coming back to us at some point with...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley would be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you.
The Let's see. I think we've talked about the waivers in terms of the significance to Oregon's program and the, what the primary issues are. If you could turn to page 420, you see a caseload chart there that essentially tracks the temporary assistance needy family caseload trend since 95, and then projects into 2004. And if you want to plot on that line, July 96 is the implementation of temporary assistance to needy families. I think you can see over the last couple of, for the couple of years there until the year 2000, you can see what the effect of the program has been. It's been extremely effective. The total caseload dropped 64% below its high point in 94. As Ramona had mentioned yesterday, if the program were operating at the 94 levels, it would be costing us $242 million more in a biennium.
Madam Chair.
Then it does matter.
Thank you. It would be helpful, constructive, to look at this kind of information, a chart like this, along with a chart that shows what's happening with the poverty rate, so that we're looking at both pictures at the same
time. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, is to superimpose the poverty rate onto this chart. I think we could do that. Okay. In last session, the department was asked to assess its TANF program and to develop through a budget note and to develop a report that assessed the program and also presented what the primary policy issues are. The assumption at that time was that the program was operating into the kind of parameters that it had, and that we could have a lot of freedom around program choices. A reauthorization was not an issue at that stage, and the assumption was that we could do some adjustments in the way the program operates, but within the same general parameters as it has been operating, within the context of Oregon waivers. But with reauthorization and the termination of waivers, the whole picture in terms of TANF reauthorization has changed, in terms of TANF program has shifted. And the issue is, for Oregon, is how will this program be operating in the context of reauthorization? So the department completed its budget note, and we've handed it out to you there, and you have it in a binder there, a separate binder, I believe, there, the TANF program report. And what this report does is it provides you with an assessment of our program in the context of reauthorization. How we are going to get what issues reauthorization poses to us as a system, and what those mean to us, and how we are likely to be able to kind of work our way through those issues and develop a program that is compliant with what will likely reauthorization will likely pose to us with the amount of funding that's available. And It's a fairly detailed report. We've gone through a number of issues, but a number of the issues that we've talked about are covered in this report, and I think I'll be referring them to in the next couple of minutes somewhat. But there are key issues. There are really four key issues. There are the loss of waivers and what the significance of those are. There are key components in reauthorization. We know essentially what those key components are going to be, just simply because of the legislative concepts that were proposed last session. So we have a very good idea of what reauthorization is going to bring to us at this stage. Structural changes in the Oregon program, what we're going to have to do to the structure of the program to be compliant with a reauthorized program, and then specifically the strategy that Oregon is going to have to do. And I think what I'd like to be able to do is just start referring to some specific pages out of this report in order to make these points. If we could go to page 15 of this report, and what it's entitled Oregon Waivers. I'm just gonna hit on a couple of points because I think they'll begin to answer some of the questions that have been asked so far. Again, there are three critical issues in Oregon's program that we have enjoyed under the waivers. The first is our ability to design a plan based on the needs of the participant as opposed to a set criteria that's established by the federal government. We have the ability to establish the number of hours for an individual based on what their needs are as opposed to a specific formula. And we have the ability to suspend the clock, a very important feature. And if you could turn to page 17, and I think this begins to answer one of the questions that was asked earlier. Component activities. This is the current, this is how participants, the types of services that participants are in the program today, based on a percentage of the total. So in terms of program entry, at any point in time, on average, about 8% of the participants are in program entry. 5% are in education, that's classroom education, basic education. About almost 7% are in family stability types of services. And I think here's where our program begins to, I think some of the conflicts, some of the problems our program has with reauthorization start coming in, become obvious at this point in terms of the mental health and substance abuse treatment. 12% of our population are active in mental health or substance abuse treatment right now, programs. These are services that are not countable under reauthorized program. We won't be able to count this kind of activity. We can count it now. And that helps us invest funding in these services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
But are those services that will exist?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, they will exist. It will just make it a struggle for us to provide them. But the problem we will have is if we approach reauthorization directly as it is being framed, you can only really provide these services either through a short three-month window, or you can wrap them around countable activities like work experience. Well, if you're working with a population that's accessing mental health or substance abuse, wrapping around those services around a work experience doesn't work very well. We have a strategy for how to approach this issue, and it's an integral part of our reauthorization strategy. And simply put, what we are proposing to do is to create a maintenance of effort funded state general fund program that targets 25% of our temporary assistance to needy family population. And that segment that would access those services are those that are in need of mental health and substance abuse treatment so that the treatment itself becomes the plan. And by not using not using federal funds to pay for those services, those individuals enrolled in those services are not subject to the participation requirements. And we can do this without spending more money. It's just how we structure what we do have.
I guess, Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon,
I think I'm firing on all cylinders today, but just having a struggle here understanding if we're cutting back mental health and substance abuse services, then what services are we talking about accessing for these clients? I'm just missing something.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, what we're looking at is restructuring the program and operating it in a different way so that the individuals that you see here in terms of this 12% and the next column, frankly, the 15% that are actively mm-hmm. pursuing medical issues, we are going to create a service track. Our plan is to create a service track that is specifically designed for those individuals to concentrate on accessing those services. That does not require, because the mental health and substance abuse and medical issues are really provided by providers through the Oregon Health Plan, it doesn't really require a program. It doesn't have a jobs program cost associated with it, except where that portion of the infrastructure that we were talking about earlier, part of that infrastructure cost is the contracts with what we refer to as triage, mental health, substance abuse, and RNs who work in our offices to help the case management system and the individuals get connected to those kinds of services. Now that is a program cost, but it helps the system effectively get determine who should be in mental health services and get them actively enrolled in
it. I guess we're all struggling here as we, and I'm going to let Ms. Baker speak, because we're all trying to figure out, as we said here, and all the information that we have, and we're looking at the, if it's coming, and maybe we're missing something, that it's not coming through the Oregon Health Plan structure, but you have a different structure that we don't know anything about. Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, maybe I can help. TANF clients are categorical eligibles for the Oregon Health Plan. So the recent reductions in the standard populations benefit package don't affect them. However, obviously, if there are changes to reimbursements, or if the way the health plan ends up coming out of this legislature for the next biennium reduces access to mental health and substance abuse benefits, then it would affect this population. But the reductions to date on the standard population don't have an impact.
I guess because we were hearing that something may be coming down the federal pike that could have some implications for this population. So and maybe it would be best for us to wait to see what's happening federally before we know what we're talking about, because I think that's what's caused some of the confusion.
Madam Chair, I think the issue for us is not so much the cost of the services, the treatment services themselves, because they are covered through the health plan. It's really whether we can enroll participants in those kinds of services and have the hours that they are in treatment and participating in those count towards our participation rate. That's the part that's going to change. And what it will do is it will kind of force us to enroll individuals in other kinds of services.
It's a time element. Is it a time element as well that you're looking at?
Well, it is more a participation. It is more of what we can legitimately enroll participants, what kinds of services we can legitimately enroll participants in and have it paid for by the block grant.
Could you provide us, with a couple things? One, if you can for us... I know you've connected mental health and substance abuse together, but it would be nice if we knew whether those were dual or whether they're singular. And also on your medical issues, if you can provide with some of the broad categories that individuals fall in, whether we're talking about some of the autoimmune disorders, whether we're talking about chronic issues or whether we're talking about acute issues. Senator Gordley.
If I may add to the request, it would be very helpful to have an example of where these mental health and substance abuse treatment services would be accessed. Because, again, I'm still stuck on the fact that we're removing services from our communities all over the state. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley,
where is it going to exist?
The mental health delivery system serves, well, I guess simplistically, it will serve two populations, one of which is dropping away, but that same delivery system is still being paid for through the capitation rate through for mental health and substance abuse treatment for this population. The art or the issue, the difficulty for that system will be, can they still maintain infrastructure strong enough to deliver the services, even though we have individuals who we're still paying for, but is there enough of a structure there to continue to provide the services? Because right now, because we're developing a plan, that system needs to be able to provide those services. If we can't enroll these individuals in treatment, and we have a treatment-focused track, going to run into difficulty.
Thank you.
Okay.
So as you can see back on page 17, then, just to complete that chart, you can see where the participants, there's a growing number of participants that are really enrolled in barrier removal kinds of services. While job search is still a strong component at almost 15%, a good number are in barrier removal. We don't do very much classroom training, about 3%, and worksite training is still somewhere around 5%. But that's the program under waivers. So that's the program we operate today under waivers. And it will change radically under reauthorization. If I could take you to page 6 in this book, what I'm going to do is I want to take you back to some of the key components in reauthorization. And we know these are the ones that we're going to be dealing with simply because these are the common issues that are addressed in legislative concepts so far. And I'll go through this pretty quickly. The funding for block grant and both legislative concepts, and we're dealing primarily with the House Bill 4737, which was passed by the House last session, and it's the administration's proposal for welfare reform. And we are also using in this comparison the Senate Work Act, which is probably the most, which is a comparable, well, the primary piece of legislation through the Senate. So block grant funding is in both concepts is at the current level. Oregon's share of a proportion of a block grant is about $167 million annually, and that won't change. So we would expect our block grant to stay the same. Now, we've had a sizable caseload reduction, as all states have, so the fact that we're getting the same block grant is good. That's a positive thing. On the other hand, the cost of the program is becoming more expensive. Time limits, both on the next page, page 7, time limits, both concepts acknowledge the concept of a 60-month or 5-year time limit. On universal engagement, both concepts have the concept of universal engagement in terms of screening and assessing all participants for job readiness and to have service plans in place after 60 days. Now, this is something that Oregon does anyway, so that won't be unique to us. But under current regulations, in reality, states could have up to 24 months before they engage individual in employment services. And we haven't been doing that, so that won't represent much of a change for us. Hours of participation. Now, this is where it starts to change pretty radically. Both concepts have hours of participation at 40 hours or 30 hours. They vary, but that's not that different. So for our costing out, we estimate it at 35 hours a week, and then 24 hours of countable activities. And countable activities is on the next page, page 8. And as you can see, they're fairly limited in terms of what you can actually count towards that participation rate. And the participation rate is calculated that 50% of the participating families have to meet this hourly rate in terms of being in these kind of activities for 24 hours and then totally for 40 hours. So it's a 24-40 measure. So what counts towards the 24 hours, which is the primary work activity component, have listed there. It's work experience, essentially. It's work and it's work experience. Now, in the Senate version, you can count three more things. You can count some work. You can count some work search, 8 weeks of work search, or you can count. You can also count vocational education up to 24 months, and there is a provision for post-secondary education as long as states as a state option that could limit at 10% of the TANF population. But outside of the classroom training, whether it's the vocational ed at 24 months or it's post-secondary education, you can see the list is the same. So it was pretty easy for us to gauge what kind of components are going to be countable and what aren't, because there's very little difference between these when everything's said and done. The only variable there is classroom training. Work participation rates on page 9. Essentially the same. 55% of the population have to be in countable activities, moving up to 70%. Right now, the standard is 50%. Oregon has, in year 2001, Oregon had a participation rate of 72%, which is one of the highest in the nation. But then we're working off a completely different list of accountable activities. We're counting people who are in mental health and people who are in life skills and everything. So it's good. It's quite a bit different. Credits to participation on page 10. That's just in terms of these are the credits and a caseload reduction credit, which has been a very big deal for states thus far. Will under one proposal gets recalibrated, and under the other is completely eliminated. So the cover that states have had in terms of the fact that they've had enjoyed such a sizable reduction in their caseload allowed them some credit towards meeting that participation level rate is gone. Becomes gone, and just because you get recalculated in Oregon in 2001, it's fairly flat. But if you go back to chart in our presentation on page 422, and you look at the caseload chart, you can see that 95 was the mark we had. So we've had a sizable caseload reduction. So our participation expectation is about zero. And has been for some time after the credit. The last piece I want to talk about in terms of the welfare reauthorization is the waiver components, and those are covered on page 11. And I think this is significant to us. In the Senate version, there was a concept for allowing extensioning of existing waivers. 2 year 2007. However, this legislation won't be dealt with before June, which means extension is a moot point. Then the only other provision that at least the Senate version has is it allows states to apply for new sets of waivers. The House version, administration's proposal, the only really provisions around waivers are really super waiver, what's referred to as super waivers, which is program integration, where you could look at programs to integrate them, and under the context of those integrations, you could look at the eligibility and program requirements. So where does that put us? Those are essentially the key components of reauthorization. Now, the structural changes that Oregon will have to undergo to meet these requirements, if you could turn in the department's report to page 23. On page 23, what we developed the model using June 2002 data.
Could you go back just a little bit on the marriage and family formation? Could you kind of skip over that? From page 12.
Marriage and family formation, both proposals provide funding. The House version is $100 million, Senate version is $200 million. Both require matches, however, state match. One is at 50-50 and the other is at a 25 rate. Under these provisions, so these are obviously not mandatory components, under these provisions, the list of services or activities that can be funded are fairly similar in terms of marriage education, relationship skill development, parenting, financial management, conflict resolution, and, of course, being able to market the program. The list is not that different in terms of what kinds of activities you can. I think the real difference is that the amount of money and the match requirements.
The combination is
On page 13, teen pregnancy prevention is funded in both concepts at its current level of $50 million a year. Both require a match. And those are focused primarily on abstinence education.
A slight increase in one on child care.
Actually, in child care, there's a large difference between these two. The House version... current funding for child care is set at $2.7 billion. In the House version, there's a slight nudge of that up to $2.9 billion for each year. But at the Senate version, there was actually an increase of almost $1 billion, up to $3.7 billion a year as opposed to $2.7 That's and the amount of funding that's available for child care is one of the key issues, differences in the both of these proposals. I think the concern or the complaint about H.R. 4737 is that the federal government is making these really strict requirements in terms of number of hours and the types of activities that people are being enrolled in, but they're not really adequately funding it for child care, the associated child care that go along with that. The Senate version is much more generous in terms of the funding that's available for child care. But this was a concept, and again, it's got to find its way through reauthorization, and how this winds up will be one of the issues we'll be watching in terms of whether the state will have additional funding to pay for child care, or whether we will have to use our TANF funds. And I should point out that the jobs program does not use the child care development block grant funding to support our child care for participants in TANF activities at this point. But this is where the federal government would put money to increase for child care. So we'll have to address that issue.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley,
if we could go back to page 11, I need to ask about the McKinney Dental Homeless Act. Are there benefits under that act coming to the state that we should be aware of, or any planning around that act that we should be aware of?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't think I can have a reasonable answer to your question, but I can certainly get it.
Please.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe housing and economic development, Housing and Community Services Department has some participation in that particular piece of legislation.
If we could find out what that is, Madam Chair, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask a question in terms of time.
I think we
what would you like me to do?
We will adjourn it at 3 if you want to hold any more until Monday. Today is Thursday, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
It would be a week from Monday.
It would be a week from Monday.
All right.
Because we have
to start all over again.
We have to start. We will be spending next Monday dealing with 103.
Yes.
Although I think that everyone had thought that we would not be dealing with Bill 103, the economic climate and the crisis in Oregon continues. And as it continues, it means that we have to continue to work to balance the current budget. So
Madam Chair, you'd like me to resume?
Tell me how much further you need to go on your...
Well, I think I can... in terms of my discussion, I probably can wrap it up in about 10-15 minutes, I think.
Well, we need to end at 3, so.
Okay.
So why don't we save that, and you can come back. And then you can put together the answers to the questions that the panel, that the members have raised, and it would be, and that would be very, very helpful so that we get off to a fresh start 3 weeks ago. And I want to thank you for your contribution to Rosie.
My weekly tithe is there too.
And we have our good Representative Bates has put in his weekly tithe, and anyone else who would like to contribute. Sincerely, today we talked about earlier we were in the food stamps and hunger, I know that this particular the agency. When we have and no one wants to say the word recession, but, it really does feel like it. And when that occurs, human services need to go up. And I can't remind the members of this panel even more, because the human needs are there that we cannot forget about. So with that, I'm going to adjourn today until... What's the date?
The 31st.
The 31st. Mm-hmm. of costs.
Or until noticed.
Or until noticed. And I wanted. No, 31st. It can't be. This is February.
Yes.
We don't have 31 days.
28.
See, you know, it
I'm
just
a month
shows.
Ahead.
It just shows how hard
we're
working.
Never coming
our
back.
Staff.
We're never coming back.
March 3rd.
March 3rd.
You know, well, I tell you, we are adjourned until further notice.